Indigenous languages around the world are dying, but a language research project in Finland is working to preserve them and to integrate them into speech recognition systems. As part of its effort to create speech recognition systems for the Hawaiian language, Lionbridge Global Services for Machine Intelligence is looking for fluent Hawaiian speakers. And as Finland-based Lionbridge Research and Global Sourcing Manager Enlil Sturbu told us earlier this morning, that effort is part of a larger mission.
We are working with all the so-called long-tail languages, so languages that are spoken in isolated communities or by very few speakers in the world. For instance, we have many other revived languages that we work with. So the whole concept is that all languages are like equally important, and we are kind of, you know, like fighting against globalization of the languages. We wouldn't want a world that would only speak, you know, like English or Chinese in 200 years. So this is part of our work, and Hawaiian is part of our portfolio. We wouldn't expect that actually there are so few Hawaiian speakers, because, you know, all the world knows about Hawaii, Honolulu, and here in Europe is like the kind of the expression of the heaven, an exotic place with nice people and sun and so on. But when we got to make our researches on the language, we actually realized that the situation is much more complicated than we expected before we started. So yes, actually at the moment we are at a kind of a critical point with Hawaiian, because it seems that we are not able to find enough speakers for our research.
Well, maybe we can, maybe there's a way to send some people your way, because we have here in Hawaii, there has been a revitalization of the Hawaiian language. There's a very strong local movement to keep that language alive. As you look at languages around the world, though, it sounds as if one of the concerns of your project is keeping indigenous languages alive, right?
Exactly. So we are also working with the North American native languages and with the native languages in South America, with languages like almost extinct in Europe, but they are like now being revitalized, like Manx in the a small part of UK, and even local dialects that are not actual languages, but they are quite different than the standard languages. So, yes, all this is part of what we are doing.
Why is it important to keep alive a language that only a few people speak?
Because it is a language. Imagine how long it took for that language to develop, and all the history and the culture behind this. So if a language is lost, it's not only, you know, like a kind of dictionary. It's like the whole world that goes with it. Even if some traditions are still kept alive, without the language itself, it's not the same. So, and many of them are actually getting like Hawaiian, for instance, now. So it's taught in many schools. So probably in some time there will be much more pools of speakers of Hawaiian that we had, let's say, 20 years ago. So a language is never dead. It can be revived. Another example would be the Jewish population that has revived their own language, and now actually it is their previous language that is getting revitalized, Yiddish. So
yeah.
Everything is possible if there is a will behind it.
Well, that's a good thought, and it sounds as if you have a special interest in languages that have developed in in physical geographic isolation, as though they don't indigenous languages in remote areas where they're not influenced by languages from other places. Is that right?
This is correct, indeed. But it's also about languages that have actually evolved in, on quite of a large areas, just that the political, economical situation, for instance, I'm not talking about languages in South America, like Aztec, for instance, then they were not, favorable, and then they less and less speakers were speaking those languages, and yes, but usually the most challenging ones, the most difficult ones, and also the most exciting ones, I would say that are those that are, like you said, in isolation, and
because you really see the entire your description of the centuries it took to develop a language, I think, was a very powerful one, because you're right, the whole culture is contained in a language, isn't it?
It is, and it's a way of living as well, because especially people that are bilingual or trilingual, they can see better, and there are researches that even the way you behave and the way you think depends on the language that you are speaking. So it's a kind of a great opportunity, to do something good, and this comes along also with the interest of the most important players in the internet area, because at the moment everybody is developing the speech recognition. So, for you to be able to talk with your car, with your phone, or TV, or computer. And this is where we need to push now. We need to get also these languages developed.
So
and,
you need
processed to be available, yeah.
You need Hawaiian speakers to get in touch with you, fluent Hawaiian speakers.
Yes, fluent Hawaiian speakers. For Hawaiian, our policy is that we are not really looking, like for other languages, for native speakers, but for speakers, for fluent speakers, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that is part of eventually to become a part of a speech recognition program?
This will help the speech recognition as well. Of course, there are like many stages. There is, the speech collection, and then it's about transcribing the speech and annotating it in order to process the data. But yes, mainly the main goal nowadays is to use this data for speech recognition, so to be implemented in all the technology that is using speech recognition. And little by little, as we were talking, every kind of device will have this speech recognition implemented. And, the best devices will be those that have the more languages, a wide choice, so anyone in the world could use their own language. That would be great.
That was Ellen Sturbu speaking to us from Finland. She's Research and Global Sourcing Manager with Lionbridge Global Services for Machine Intelligence. Lionbridge is looking for fluent Hawaiian speakers 18 years of age or over, and you can learn more about the project on our Facebook page. It's been a tough couple of years for political prognosticators. The 2016 election sent the majority of them back to their data to take another hard look because they thought for sure Hillary would win. That said, it's with some caution that we buy into the predictions that are floating around for the upcoming midterms. Renewed citizen engagement, the revitalized gun control effort, the Me Too movement. Conversation contributing editor Neil Milner is with us in our studio to take the long view, wondering to what degree predictions of an upcoming sea change in American politics will come true. Good morning, Neil.
Hi, Chris.
We've been hearing it's become sort of an article of faith. Oh, boy, this year the midterms are going to see a real shakeup, and, you know, we're not going to turn back on gun control, and the kids from Parkland are inspiring us. And how much of that do you think is actually going to play out at the polls?
Well, the answer is we don't know, and there are reasons to be skeptical, sound reasons to be skeptical about it. But let me go back and say where this comes from. It comes, where I got interested in, again, was a recent study by Marcus Pryor and Lori Bueger, published in the Public Opinion Quarterly, who took a look at interest and participation on the part of voters and possible voters in the 2016 race. Mm-hmm. And they looked at the difference between the way the media constantly described that, which is the way you just described
it. Right.
It was unprecedented, quote, like we have never seen before.
Yes.
And although the 2016 election was bizarre and often nutty, and often things happen that we said that's certainly going to change the dynamics here. Mm-hmm. It turns out that interest in and participation in the 2016 election, from that standpoint, the 2016 election was quite ordinary. That the voting turnout was not that particularly high, not that particularly low. Mm-hmm. The people, the Trump supporters, the white non-college males, didn't participate any more than they normally do. Mm-hmm. Viewership of cable news didn't change. What you saw instead was there was an initial increase early on in the primaries, probably because you had such a bizarre kind of primary. People watched the primary debates, but by the time the election moved on, we fell back into a typical kind of election pattern, which means the kinds of things I described, plus the usual relatively low voting turnout. The voting turnout in these elections were not, in the 2016, were not that particularly mm-hmm. high. So the cautionary tale is this. It's a reminder, as they point out in this article, of two things. Media tends to hype. That is, the media is about narrative, is about talking about the exceptional stuff, about change. Mm-hmm. What we know about the way people approach elections, that doesn't change very much. Mm-hmm. The kinds of interest we have, the kinds of ways we look for information is pretty stable. It doesn't change in any kind of extraordinary way, even if you have an election, which I would constitute as a pundit as totally nutty. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really enough to make the change. So the analogy here is this. We're talking about the extraordinary response on the part of young voters, mm-hmm. Potential voters as a result of Parkland and so on. And it is extraordinary in terms of participation right now. But we, just because it's there and just because that's what the media is emphasizing, doesn't mean when the time comes for the 2018 election that we're going to have that.
These are what they're now referring to as optics, right? This is what you see on the
sure.
on the television. It may or may not mean anything. You know, we've had a number of pivotal events that led to the birth of the Me Too movement mm-hmm. and the Parkland shooting. And each of those, just to use them as examples, has brought people into the streets in massive numbers. And a sensation in the narrative, in the media narrative du jour, that, okay, now this is a sea change. Now it's really going to bring about the change that a lot of people have been waiting for. But we said that after Sandy Hook with gun control. We've said it any number of times about a number of things, right?
Sure.
It doesn't necessarily play out at the polls.
No, and there's two things going on here in a general sense. I'm only talking about one of them. One thing is Congress's lack of willingness to respond to this because of the power of NRA. Mm-hmm. That's another side that's obviously important. Here I'm talking about the fact that what we see in these events is what you see right now and the kind of emotion that gets forward. Mm-hmm. An election is very different. First of all, an election is not today, it's later.
Right.
And that involves more people participating. And we really don't know very much about who's being influenced by this kind of thing. This is a very hard thing for me to talk about because I've had to have these discussions with lots of people who are totally enamored by the Parkland kids and all of that in their courage, but to remind them that voter turnout, especially among young 18 to whatever, 20-something. Yeah. Now, there's a little bit of evidence that that's changing. Voter turnout among in any group doesn't change very much from election to election, and the young voters are always the least likely to vote. Mm-hmm. In the Virginia primary recently, where the Democrat in the Virginia election, the Democrat did very well. The voter turnout from the younger voters was twice what it normally is, and it was 34% rather than 17%. Now that was a very particular election. So that there is some possibilities out there that it will increase. But there's no reason to assume that the passion that you see will translate into the normal person's concern about this election.
And that leads to just a thought I just had, Neil, which is that pouring into the streets in the wake of a Parkland shooting for a demonstration the Women's March that was part of the Me Too movement. These are done in hot blood, right? They're done when the blood is up. They're acts of political passion. Getting up on a Tuesday when you've got to go to work and trying to figure out where your voting place is not a particularly intense emotional act. People don't pour into the streets to vote. They go, oh, yeah, today's election day. I don't think I'm going to make it. I got to go to work. Whatever. My point is one is a hot-blooded, the other is a cold-blooded decision.
And for most people, not the people that talk about politics all the time, politics is not hot-blooded. Politics is more or less following. So the fact that you have a lot of these people on and on television and that it's very controversial, the parties are somewhat polarized about that, doesn't mean that your average person is paying that much attention to it, is following things. If the pattern stays the same, then it's a relatively low, ordinary kind of participation. The real question is whether something is extraordinary enough to change people's behavior. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind how many times your friends who were Trump opponents said, he's done something so extraordinary this time.
Now he's done it.
And guess what? It never happened. Yeah. And that's not just about Trump and his demagoguery or anything else. It's also about the way our minds tend to work about politics.
It reflects an understanding on the part of him and his people how intensely people respond or do not respond to events.
Sure. Sure. A lot of what an election is about is non-response, ordinary patterns, relatively lack of interest. And even when you think you have an extraordinary election, it turns out that a lot of the patterns remain the same because our basic views and our basic notions to pay attention or not pay attention to politics really are quite stable.
I think there's a lot of sense in what you're telling me, Neil. And also,
I hope so.
Why else would you be here?
Well, I don't know.
But notwithstanding, and I think there's probably a lot of truth in that, it's going to be a heck of an election year.
For sure. For all kinds of other reasons. Yeah. Again, there's all kinds of unprecedented things, literally unprecedented things going on. The number of Republicans in Congress who are not running for re-election, the low approval rating of the president, which in normal midterm elections is an important factor. But also on the other side of that, the polarization of opinions about him, that Republicans highly support him, highly, highly, and Democrats low, low. All of these things are extraordinary in some ways. How this will translate into the election remains to be seen. It's going to mix in with these fairly stable patterns.
As Betty Davis once said, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yes, it is.
Political analyst Neil Milner is our contributing editor for our biweekly segment, The Long View.
Thank you.
Now, you know, we're coming up to the second crossover at the state legislature when bills cross back over to the originating house. And joining us for today's reality check is Courtney Teague from Honolulu Civil Bee. Morning, Courtney.
Morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. Now, we've started out with, what, some 5,000 bills you wrote, and now we're down to a couple hundred, but now's when we really have to watch.
Yeah, yeah. Second crossover is a big, big deadline for the legislature. Usually goes pretty smooth. There might be some discussion here or there on certain bills. But this most recent one yesterday was an interesting one. Things got a little weird on the Senate side, to say the least. So this session, we've seen a lot more bills that have been gutted and replaced, which essentially means that a bill's original contents have been gutted and replaced with something usually quite different. So on the Senate side, there was quite a bit of confusion among legislators, a lot of recesses and huddles and frantic whispers. and most of the confusion focused around two bills from what we understand, both of those related to Mauna Kea.
Right. Hot topic for everybody with, I think they were talking about what an authority, potentially the whole management of the mountain.
Right. One of those bills would have taken the control of the mountain from the University of Hawaii, which is currently tasked with managing it. That bill was totally gutted, or that bill was the product of a gut and replace. So it was originally something totally different related to ag land and affordable housing, and ended up being a bill about Mauna Kea. Now, there is a second Mauna Kea bill. That one would have required an audit of the University of Hawaii regarding its activities with the mountain. And that bill was actually kind of a double gut and replace. So that was a gut and replace bill that was actually replaced with another bill that had been gutted and replaced. And definitely a lot of confusion about those two bills yesterday.
Right. And I know a lot of lawmakers are troubled about the process. You know, I was talking to someone in the House and they were saying, well, you know, at least we're trying to be transparent. You know, it gets a little dicey because you do want the public to have their say. And when you do stuff like this at the last minute, things can get lost.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of lawmakers who are a fan of this tactic say, well, you know, it's the only way we can keep the discussion alive. It's the only way we can keep this legislation moving, which is true. But that comes at the cost with a lot less public input, sometimes really no public input. And it also effectively kills another bill, right? Even though you are keeping another alive.
Right. And then, again, the whole thought is that these bills will go to conference. But then the public doesn't get any input at that point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you can get notice of these hearings like an hour or two before. So it really gets down to the wire at conference committee. You know, there is a chance for lawmakers from both chambers to kind of hash things out, and possibly the bill could revert back to, you know, one of its earlier drafts. But, you know, we just have to wait and see at this point.
Right. Okay. So we'll be tracking to see what other big stuff gets through this second crossover. But thanks so much for joining us, Courtney.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Courtney Teague with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting Tchaikovsky's passionate tale of unrequited love, Eugene Onegin, April 20th to the 24th at the Blaisdell. Tickets at hawaiioperatheater.org.
You didn't know, today is International Barbershop Quartet Day. We were surprised to learn of it, but 80 years ago today is when we in the U.S. began officially honoring the wonderful a cappella style of singing that has its roots in barbershops. In 1938, back before there was radio, TV, or internet, Hanging out at the barbershops was a real social part of the community. And thanks to the marvelous contributions of a group of African-American singers, the genre of musical delight was born. We decided to drop in on rehearsals last week at the Sounds of Aloha Chorus for our barbershop fix, where director Mark Conching was fine-tuning his members. I'm out and about in Makiki, and the focus tonight.
Blue skies.
Over 70 years old, we're actually the oldest barbershop chorus this side of the Rockies. It started actually with a lot of prominent guys in our neighborhood, like Governor Burns was a barbershopper, Val Ossipoff, the famous architect, was a barbershopper, Peter Leong, a famous investor, was a barbershopper. But we meet every Thursday, normally at the Alawai Golf Course Clubhouse. We rehearse for a few hours and we sing in a four-part a cappella style known as barbershop. But April 11th is actually International Barbershop Harmony Day, and that commemorates the first meeting ever of barbershop aficionados in Kansas City. It was the first time they ever organized to be an actual barbershop group.
And so tell us, if folks are interested in joining this group, what do they have to do?
We have we're open every Thursday for any guests to come in and just give it a shot. We normally ask you to come to a few rehearsals first to see if you like what we do and to see if you like our style. After that, if you'd like to try out for the group, we have open auditions every Thursday. And for that, you just really need to be able to sing something. You can sing Happy Birthday or God Bless America or anything you like. We just got to see what your voice is like and if you can hold a tune. And if you're a nice guy, we kind of let you in.
Okay. And so is there like an age limit or requirement?
We have guys all the way from high school guys to octogenarians singing in our style, which is one of the really neat things about barbershop is that it really encompasses a wide range of not only ages but also demographics.
And so like if someone were to audition, you know, what's the process?
Normally what we'd have you do is sing something like anything that you would choose, whether it's Happy Birthday or anything that you like. Then we try to see if you can sing in harmony. We do sing in four-part harmony and require that guys joining our chorus be able to do that style. So we'll teach you something. We'll give you a few weeks to prepare for it. Then you come back and you actually sing in a quartet. And if you can do that, you're a part of the group.
And so you already have some established quartets that go out and about and perform.
We do. We have five quartets now. The quartets are Resonance, Full Measure, Funny Bones, a quartet called Wong Fu, and my quartet, 19th Avenue. And we go out and perform all over the island.
And so any particular songs that you gravitate to? I don't know what makes one quartet different than another.
Our quartets actually do gravitate to different styles. Funny Bones obviously does stuff in the comedy style. Resonance really likes things in that Frank Sinatra, Rat Pack kind of style. Our chorus actually is concentrating on songs from what they call the Great American Songbook, which is songs that have become standards in between the 1920s and about the 1960s. And right now we're rehearsing for a couple of performances. We're going to do a show over at Kauai Ha'o, and then we're going to sing for Memorial Day over at Punch Bowl.
How many numbers will you go through in the evening?
We'll probably sing 7 or 8 numbers throughout the evening. We do quite a bit of rehearsing in 2 hours.
And I know you've got there's a women's group in town that's the Sweet Adelaide, right?
There's actually 2 Sweet Adelaide groups in town. One is called Naleo Lani, and they've been here for over 50 years. And there's a brand new one. They've only been here 8 or 9 years, and they're called the Honolulu Blend Show Chorus, and they're both very, very good choruses. If you're a woman and want to sing in the barbershop style, those are 2 great avenues to choose.
And do you ever perform with them?
Actually, quite often. We're a very small barbershop community here with only 3 choruses, so we try to perform together whenever we can.
Is there any on the neighbor islands?
There aren't any. Somebody has tried to start one in Maui. They tried to start one in Kona. It's certainly difficult when you don't have the resources that we have here, because we just have a lot of barbershoppers who have been doing this for a long time, and they don't have it there, but they are really interested in the style. So we're going to actually try and help them start one in Maui soon.
I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange colored sky.
Not bad, not bad at all for a Thursday evening pickup rehearsal. That was Mark Conching, director of the Sounds of Aloha Choral Group. The singers were practicing for an upcoming show at Kauai Ha'o Church. It's a free choral festival on April 28th. It starts at 4 p.m. For links, you can log on to our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.